Shall we go? Yes, let's go. They do not move. Start With This, a podcast featuring Night Vale creators Joseph Fink and me, Jeffrey Craner. Each episode, we discuss a topic and then give you two assignments, something to consume and something to create. Start With This, absurdity.
Art is hard. Starting is hard. If you wanna start somewhere, you can start with this. You can start with this.
For me, one of the most unnerving scenes in David Lynch's very unnerving film Mulholland Drive is when the character Adam returns home and sees the pool cleaner truck out front of his house, but no one is cleaning the pool. He goes inside calling for his wife, but no one answers. He goes to the back bedroom and catches his wife in bed with the pool cleaner, played by Billy Ray Cyrus. But instead of the cheating couple showing fright or humility at being caught, they're both sitting upright in bed and staring directly at Adam. And the wife says, "Now you've done it," and the pool cleaner says, "Just pretend you never saw it." It's shocking because the scene does not respect our expectations. The characters don't respect a common sense of morality or normal behavior, and we see the confusion and fear on Adam's face. I've always found horror and humor in the unexpected. I grew up reading Alice's Adventures in Wonderland over and over, always surprised by the twists and turns of her surreal ride, the counterintuitiveness of each character, and the illogical juxtaposition of each physical location. Absurdity is technically defined as being ridiculous or wildly unreasonable, but it's been used in art as an expression of general confusion and existential dread. See Samuel Beckett's Endgame, where the elderly couple lives in separate garbage cans. It's used in satire and humor. See The Onion, with headlines like, "You meet the most interesting people kicking open random bathroom stalls," and "Christ returns to the NBA. It's also used in world building and character development to construct a universe that disorients us from the commonplace in order to focus us on something else. See the exploration of relationship dynamics in Terrence Malick films or the racial politics of the Watchmen TV series. Absurdity is disorienting to be sure, but if wielded right, that can create intrigue, but push it too far into the surreal and you might lose people. Now you've done it. I'm Jeffrey Craner, here with Joseph Fink. Shall we go?
Yes, let's go. I read that play once. I can't quote it accurately.
It's quite a wild ride, that play. I didn't realize how funny Waiting for Godot was after I read it in college, until I actually saw a production of it in Dallas a few years after I graduated college, and I realized this play is hilarious. And our professor told us it was funny, but it's one of those plays that you read and you don't see a single joke written into the entire thing, and it just sounds like meandering existentialism on the page. It felt to me when I read that play like a real trudge through academic literature. But yeah, it's very funny, and it's mostly in the physical comedy, I suppose, of that.
Yeah, it reminds me of you just started reading a book by Vladimir Nabokov, and you had a kind of similar reaction I did the first time I read anything by Nabokov, because he's known as he's either known for like the controversy of having written Lolita, or the kind of known as like a difficult author that you read for academic reasons. And the truth is, when you read his stuff, it's very funny. Yeah, it's a very readable sense of humor that doesn't come up much in discussions of him.
He does a thing very early in the book Pale Fire that you recommended to me, where the preface is written by this sort of the main narrator of the book is analyzing this poem, and he starts with a preface before publishing the poem and then having his breakdown of this whole poem. That's the entire structure of the novel. But in the preface, he's talking about the author of the poem, and just out of nowhere comes a paragraph where the writer of the preface, the narrator of the whole book, just interrupts this like academic discussion about this poet and this poem that he wrote. And just in the middle of it, the narrator says, "And I can hardly hear myself think right now because there's a carnival outside of my house and it's making so much noise." And then he just continues on. I just kept having to look at that over and over again. It absolutely does that alienating thing that absurdity does, but it's pointing towards something bigger about his character. And it's more and more that seeps in over the course of the book. This is actually...
He does... go ahead. So I apologize to divert us one more time, but he actually... This is going to be... I don't know if you plan to read it, but if you are, you might want to, like, I could just mute my microphone. But this is spoilers for the book Lolita. But he does a kind of similarly interesting thing on the very first page. Do you want me to mute my mic so you don't
hear? No, please go ahead. I will take it in. I'll forget it, I'm sure.
The book actually doesn't start with that famous quote, the a trip of three down the tongue or whatever. It actually starts with this preface by an outside academic talking about the book, and it briefly mentions the death of this. He's kind of just talking about the people who are in the book, and of course, Mrs. Whatever died in Alaska at this date. And it's not till you get to the very end of the book you realize that Mrs. Whoever is Lolita, and that Lolita dies on page one. And you have no way of knowing that because it's not a name you know her by until the end of the book.
Oh, fascinating. Lolita died. Well, see, that's not a spoiler. She died on page one. They say it right in the very beginning. So absurdity is a word I sort of throw around a lot in my, in describing things. Like if I'm describing a book or a story or a movie or whatever to somebody, I might say it uses a lot of the, it's absurd or it has absurd qualities to it. And I was trying to sort of in this episode sort of pin down maybe more specifically what I mean, or maybe I'm trying to find a more broad definition of what makes something absurd in writing. Like if somebody describes something as absurd, do you sort of have a broad vision of what that is in your mind? Does it conjure up anything specific for you, Joseph?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's so many delineations. We often use words like weird or absurd or surreal or creepy or eerie in these kind of interchangeable ways, but you can also really get into trying to delineate the definitions. I was actually just listening to someone was reading a passage that was just an academic trying to break down the exact difference between weird and eerie, which was just a super interesting difference to think about. With absurdity, here's my off-the-cuff definition of absurdity that's based on nothing, which is just, I think absurdity is weirdness that is used to amplify something that exists in the world. Like the idea of absurdity is taking a concept that sort of already exists, or a problem, or just something about life that's a little bit off, and then blowing it up in this way that it becomes clear. Like, I feel like the jarringness of absurdity is it reveals something real about the world to you, even though it's very silly. There's some kernel that it started as before it was blown up into this absurd thing.
Yeah, in some ways it works like a magnifying glass, and in some ways it works like a kaleidoscope. Maybe, there's something else about it. It shows either by exaggerating a pattern or something like a magnifying glass or like a kaleidoscope. You know what's in a kaleidoscope. It's a series of different colored shapes and beads and
please don't spoil a kaleidoscope.
I'm sorry. And a lot of different mirror. I don't know. I'm speaking like somebody who knows how to design a kaleidoscope. I haven't gotten to that stage of Animal Crossing yet where I can craft that. But generally what you're looking at, but it angles and refracts everything into a way that creates all new patterns from really mundane items of just different colored beads and plastic shapes. Yeah, I like that idea of the absurdity is something that is pointing out something else. Maybe unlike surrealism, not to say that surrealism has no point, it's just it's not pointing at any one thing necessarily or directing you someplace else. Surrealism is sort of in some ways chaos for chaos' sake or poetry for poetry's sake in some form or fashion. I know I'm simplifying that, but
yeah, I feel like surrealism is trying to get at sort of a dream logic truth. It's trying to kind of create a thing that feels emotionally right, but maybe doesn't have a point of reference in the real world. Dali's work, it's not necessarily about anything, but it has this certain dream truth to it where you're like, yeah, I've felt like this spindly legged elephant at some point in some way.
Yes.
Whereas I feel like the, for instance, taking the example of you used of the moment in the David Lynch film in which there's this cheating couple caught and they're acting in this way that doesn't fit. It's absurd, but it also is blowing up or magnifying just sort of this disconnect that can happen between people that maybe people think that they're close and they don't understand each other the way they thought they did. And this is sort of really magnifying that disconnect between these people. by turning it to an absurdity.
Yeah. And it's interesting because that's one of the more like narratively tangible scenes in all of Mulholland Drive, which is, it's a very classic standard scene of the pool, you know, the wife is sleeping with the pool cleaner, sort of having an affair with the day worker. And, you know, the husband comes home and catches them in the act. And then the absurdity of that scene is turning that trope to where they're blaming him. So it puts the character of Adam in even more discomfort, even more trouble. So this protagonist, one of the protagonists of this film, his life is getting worse and worse and worse. More things are piling on more things. And this is just one of them. It's not just about his wife sleeping with the pool guy. It's about the fact that it's his fault, which you could say it is. But it's also in that moment, you don't know entirely who he is or what's happening there. I'm sort of interested. I was having this conversation with Rose Eveleth, who does the Flash Forward podcast. And I've had this sort of like theory in the back of my head where, like, not to be all like generational here, but, you know, when you talk about like boomers and Gen X and millennials, et cetera, but I do feel like every kind of like generation or every kind of like span of 20, 30 years, there's kind of this, there's like a sense of humor that I feel connected to that generation. I always think that in the boomer generation, sarcasm was a predominant approach to comedy, and then with Gen X, irony. And I sort of feel like what's happening now from the millennials to whatever we call this newer, younger generation, when you look at TikTok, that absurdity is really prevalent. And I think back to my theater classes in college, and we learned about the theater of the absurd and theater of the absurd in the 20th century with people like Samuel Beckett and Eugene Ionesco. It was a reaction to world events. It was a reaction to depression and war and fascism and things like that, and this loss of control. It was a sense of helplessness and meaninglessness in life. It was like uber existentialism. And I'm just sort of curious if you think that absurdity comes in waves based off of cultural events or world events.
Yeah, I mean, I think art is always going to be related in some way, even if it's not about what's going on. It's always going to reflect what's going on. I don't feel like qualified to try to figure out exactly that connection. I mean, I think partly it's world events. I think also the internet kind of rewards absurdity. It's a really absurd form to work in, the internet, partly because it allows you to do things that you couldn't before that were absurd. Like, I feel like maybe this is even delineating more, because like, this is very much was like a millennial thing, and now we're to like Gen Z or whatever on TikTok. You know, there was the, I don't know if you remember the Smash Mouth Eat the Eggs, which was just a guy on Twitter whose handle is Fart, @Fart, started a campaign to get the guy from Smash Mouth to eat, I think it was 2 dozen eggs. I don't remember. It was a lot of eggs. And so that's like the start, and it's just kind of this funny, absurd idea. But the thing about the internet is then a bunch of people started petitioning him to eat the eggs, and also started offering to donate a lot of money to charity if he did. And eventually he did, in fact, eat all of those eggs at an event hosted by Guy Fieri, because Guy Fieri is friends with the guy from Smash Mouth, unsurprisingly. So it's like the internet kind of rewards the fact that you can start with this absurd idea and then it echoes and builds it into two bigger and bigger things.
Yeah, I was about to get into, I just kind of broke down some of the areas of the way absurdity is used and the sort of the effects that it can have. But one of them, I just will jump to the bottom of the list, which is just humor, right? Like the absurd is hilarious. I think you and I both read one or some of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books. And, you know, the absurdity is the key to all of the humor in Douglas Adams' books. There's satire in there, yes, but also a lot of it is there for the sake of being funny. The idea of like turning expectations on its head in a way that's hilarious. And I'm such a big fan of TikTok, and was a fan of Vine as well, and the absurd humor that shows itself there. And I think you're totally right. I think that the internet rewards that sort of thing. I also feel like it's part of that is related to just there's so much now. Like, everybody can be a creator in some form or fashion and get their humor or get their sensibilities or get their message out to more than just the people in their immediate social circle because of the internet. That there's something to this, like, absurdity is a way in which you can try to do something that nobody's done before. You can try and find a sense of humor. And I just think 20th century, say, stand-up comedy was so much based in the world of observational humor. And not that we will ever run out of observational humor or that would ever go away, but I think there's an observation has most likely already been made in that front, and you run the risk if you push that too far, observational humor pushed too far can veer towards like sexism, racism, transphobia, etc. And absurdism kind of helps you find some new take that is not so extreme as those things.
Yeah, and it also can kind of serve as a challenge to the idea that things need to be observational. I think a little bit about, and I don't know if you could call this absurdism, but I think it has elements of that of, God, what was the name of Hannah Gatsby's big breakthrough?
Nanette.
And I forget even who Nanette was. She was not a major character. And then her new special is called Douglas, and I've seen it. I went and saw it live. It was very funny. And Douglas is the name of her dog, who features in like half an anecdote. And so there's something like, I think, a lot of stand-up comedy before that, the titles were very like, I don't know, you think of stand-up comedy titles as like being very like about how good the comic is, or they might be ironic jokes, kind of, you know, kind of funny. and there's something like sort of challenging about being like, no, I'm gonna write this piece that actually has a lot to say, and then I'm gonna name it after somebody who's barely in it. There's this sort of challenge to the idea that this has to mean something or point to something.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. That you bring up names is really interesting too, because I think in the internet age and the 21st century, right, that we have, you know, the idea of naming your new internet startup a word that actually means something or a phrase that actually connects to what it is. You know, when you think of something like Uber, you know, there's so many, or where are we at now? Quibi? Is that how you say it? The new Quibi?
I was reading it as Quibi.
Quibi or Quibi?
I've never heard it said out loud. So yeah. Your guess is as good as mine.
Or even TikTok or what have you, that there's this element of creating something that is a name that is evocative of something, but it doesn't directly describe what it is you're doing. And there is that sort of a quality to absurdity as well. I wrote down a few of these components of absurdity and what absurdity can do. Let me start with disorientation. I think of like bringing back the Alice Isn't Dead, or actually I meant to say Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which is it sort of creates more of a question or a mood rather than an answer or a story in that sense. The idea of like keeping your reader, your listener always on their toes. And I think in some ways, that's a way of escapism. It's a way of escaping reality as a form of comfort. I always found comfort in like the horror and humor of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland when I was a kid, because I just felt lost. I like the idea of being in a maze, being not entirely certain where something is going, even if I've read it before. It takes me completely out of my own world. And then also there's the more confrontational nature of it, where you want to confront your audience with something so disorienting that you want them to even question their own reality.
Yeah, I mean, I think absurdity can be kind of, you know, going to Welcome to Night Vale. The thing about absurdity is it can start as absurdity, and then if you make it consistent enough, if you make it so it's absurd in the same way every time, it starts to feel logical in itself. It starts to feel like its own world. To use an example that we didn't write, that we sometimes kind of reference less as a tonal point, but as more as a world-building idea, is the Discworld books. And Discworld started out as sort of an absurd parody of fantasy books. That was kind of, if you read the first couple, they feel very different than later ones, because it was clearly just written as a straight up parody of fantasy novels, without much thought being put into a larger world. And then gradually, by just keeping that world consistent and like bringing characters and events back continually, you read later books, and I mean, it's still a very absurd world. But it definitely feels like a tangible place you can go visit, because it was so consistent over 40 some books.
It's really interesting to sort of turn that. That's another thing I had, which is related to disorientation, is subversion, of just inverting people's expectations. And I think of subversion as something more like a political act or something that you're trying to wrangle some pre-existing notion and then they kind of turn it on its head to make people really, really think through this truism or this like moral truth and actually really question its value. But it's sort of interesting too of being able to take that same subversion, that same parody, and actually go so deep into it that you start loving it, that you start actually kind of admiring the world that you're previously parodying, that you're maybe start beginning with a mocking, and then it turns into something where you're like, actually, I belong in here. I mock it because I like it.
There's some issues with him and what he's his work, but I think about like Sacha Baron Cohen when you think about using absurdity in political commentary. Because the thing about absurdity is because it seems at first to be so ridiculous, it can kind of make you drop your guard. It can kind of catch you. And so his whole method is built around that, in that he gets people to admit to things on camera or say things on camera that they would never say in any other situation. But because he creates this atmosphere that is so patently absurd, he completely catches them off guard and gets them to admit to these really horrible truths or like points of view that they hold and are very careful about hiding. You know, sort of the classic, this is kind of long before his more famous stuff, I think, or maybe it was in one of the movies, I don't remember, but he did that thing where he played like a like amateur singer from a different country. It might have been the Borat character, I don't remember, but he just went to like an open mic night and sang this song called Throw the Jews in the Well, which was just this horribly anti-Jewish song. But because he was playing this very goofy character and doing it in this over-the-top way, everyone started singing along and really having a great time with this hugely anti-Semitic song. And Sacha Baron Cohen, who is Jewish, was using this absurd character to just reveal the naked anti-Semitism that was in this room already. And it took the absurdity to make people drop their guard and reveal it.
It's absolutely fantastic. That's in making this episode, I ended up making one on satire as well. So we'll talk more about political satire or just satire in general. But yeah, I think that's, I do think that was from Borat, but I can't remember. A couple other things I had was talking about scale. One of the things we talk about in writing Night Vale is we make the mundane frightening and the frightening mundane, or the, you know, the commonplace absurd and the absurd commonplace. The big is small and the small is big. So absurdity is growing the scale of something and shrinking the scale of something in ways that are completely unrealistic. It's a great way of highlighting binary differences. And it's really also an interesting way to just create really funny jokes. Also in chaos, I think, is the thing absurdity can do. I thought about Jackson Pollock. You sort of destroy all sense of realism, the expectation that a painting is a thing. And you begin to see through chaos, his is a controlled chaos, but it is a chaos on the canvas. And you begin to see a new picture, a new aesthetic, something that is, to use the idea of like Jungian imagery earlier of surrealism, you create something that is sort of like beyond what's created in nature. You sort of create something that is an entirely new pattern. Absurdism is kaleidoscope rather than magnifying glass. And then lastly, before we run out of time, we should speak a little bit about meaninglessness and dissonance. Meaninglessness, brought up earlier when I talked about theater of the absurd. If you think about the novel Catch-22, this is where you create a constant level of absurdity to where you realize that there's nothing you can do about anything in life, that things are so absurd that you really just start depicting a level of helplessness. Catch-22 wants you to laugh at that, but it's also a very tragic novel for what's really going on there. And you have that. But lastly, I wanted to bring up dissonance. We've referenced Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. And I think going back to the Mulholland Drive example, that was sort of an example of dissonance, you know, that what you expect to happen is just slightly off. It's sort of realistic. But in The Lottery, you've got we're going to spoil The Lottery here, but you've got the Hutchinson family and the wife, Tessie. As the whole township is coming out for the lottery, everyone in town is sort of tense about this, but everybody's excited. It's a big town-wide event. It's like there's going to be a carnival or a parade in town. There is something where this is really exciting. And as you read through this, and Tessie's husband Bill draws the black piece of paper from the lottery, which means that each of his family members then has to redraw. And this is when Tessie starts protesting and getting upset. And Her husband is sort of being like, well, no, this is just how we do things. And she's getting really upset about this. And you're building this dissonance of like, this is not how we do community events. This is not how we participate in local fairs and carnivals. But yeah, I was just curious if you had any thoughts on like the idea of like dissonance in fiction or storytelling.
I think that's a really easy way to highlight the absurdity of something is sort of either inserting something that shouldn't be there or having people react in ways that they shouldn't. The react in ways that they shouldn't is one of the most, I think, unsettling forms of absurdity. It's one that David Lynch uses quite a lot. You know, I think about, and I've used this in my own work, if you see a ghost, that can be scary. But if you see a ghost and then the ghost, their eyes goes wide and they scream as though they're scared to see you, that's terrifying. There's just something about the reaction. I think because we are such social creatures, when another person, even if that person isn't a person, but doesn't react in a way that makes sense to how our social structure is programmed, it can really throw everything else, even if everything else seems normal. You know, going back to that David Lynch scene, as you said, it's a very trope scene. It's a scene we understand the narrative arc of that scene, and just by changing the reactions of the people involved, it throws the whole thing into this very unsettling place.
Well, great. Let's take a short break, and we will come back with your two assignments.
Hello, Joseph here. I have two books coming out this year. Seriously, May 11th, 2021. The first 10 years, two sides of the same love story. So there is a love story that happened behind the scenes of Welcome to Night Vale between me and Meg Bashwinner, MC and tour manager for the live Night Vale show. In this memoir, we recount the first 10 years of our relationship, year by year, without consulting each other beforehand. It's a funny and romantic story about how differently we experience and remember our lives. Then on July 20th, 2021, The Halloween Moon, my first ever novel for ages 10 and up. Esther Gold loves Halloween, until the year that Halloween night just won't end. Even she doesn't want Halloween to last forever. No matter your age, if you are a fan of what I do, I think you're going to love this book. Get these books wherever you get your books.
And welcome back. Now we're going to give you your two assignments this week. Let's start with your consume assignment, as we always do. In the show notes, I've included a YouTube link. I want you to watch this clip. It's about 8 minutes long. It is from Swedish director Roy Andersson's film, You, the Living. There's a slow build toward the absurdity in this piece. It's a dream sequence of sorts, but even then, it's pretty straightforward until it slowly but finally reveals its location and what's going on. What are the absurd elements even outside of the dream? Just note the look of the bar and the people in it, how each of them react. And in the depiction of the dream shown in this film clip, when did you recognize that it is not a realistic scene? When did you first get tipped off, other than me telling you, but visually, what tips you off to this not being a realistic story? I'll also say this, that the film You, the Living is not available in the US, from what I've been able to find, even for purchase. From streaming services, but his most recent film, A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence, is. And a content warning for that, it does have a very sharply satirical scene about white British imperialism and racism near the end that may not be your thing, but it is his style is fully absurd and amazing. So if you want to see more of his work, check out A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence, and enjoy this 8-minute clip from You, the Living.
Let's talk about your create assignment. What I want you to do is write a 200-word description of your home. Just as accurately as you can. You should know it pretty well at the moment. Do a virtual walkthrough of its floor plan, its various features. Make the whole thing realistic and true, as though you were explaining your house to somebody. Now, go back to the beginning and edit that piece and change the logic of its layout. Maybe the stairs go up to the basement, down into the attic. There's a cupboard that's filled with staplers, a toilet made of wood. With each sentence, think about the logical and expected conclusion of that part of your house and the way that you're describing it. Try to find a way to twist it into something impossible or totally out of left field. Make sure your readers never quite know where each moment is going to go.
All right. I hope you guys enjoy working on those things. Thank you so much for listening. And for those of you who have joined our membership forum, thank you for doing that and for sharing your work with us and everyone. That's all for this episode, but your assignment is just beginning. Head on over to startwiththispodcast.com to join our membership community. Becoming a member allows you to share your assignments with other listeners, talk about what's sparking your creativity, and find future collaborators. Plus, you'll be able to ask follow-up questions about this and future episodes and gain exclusive access to episodes where we answer those questions. Membership is just $5. That's like a couple of jugs of off-brand Sunny Delight. We can't wait to see what you're working on. Start With This is a production of Night Vale Presents. It's produced by me, Jeffrey Craner, editing by Grant Stewart, mixing by Vincent Cascione, theme song by Joseph Fink. All other music is by Caged Animals. Find more at cagedanimals.net. Check out nightvalepresents.com for more information about this show and all of our other shows. Thank you for listening. Joseph, we always close out with an inspirational quote about writing. This one is from the poet Jack Kerouac. You know this quote when Jack Kerouac said, "One day I will find the right words and they will be..."
Yeah, that's right. And they will be green goo rules. Those are the right words.
Thank you.
From the creators of Welcome to Night Vale, Alice Isn't Dead, and Within the Wires comes a new Audible original. Unlicensed. In the outskirts of Los Angeles, where the cul-de-sacs and strip malls sprawl into the desert, two unlicensed private investigators scrape by on whatever small cases come their way. But when a teenage girl pleads for them to take the strangest case of their career, this unlikely pair, with no resources and no backup, will follow a trail of seemingly unconnected cases, which will lead them to a ransom, a murder, a mysterious wellness center, and a conspiracy that might go all the way to the governor.
It's important to catch small fires early. They don't stay small for long.
Unlicensed. Available now at audible.com/unlicensed.